Ginny's never gonna stop searching for you.
Why? What does she want with her? Tell me.
Look, all I know is she's exactly what Ginny needs. She's the perfect subject.
You're responsible for the death of hundreds of people. You know the punishment for that.
Listen. I've found a way to live with the blood on my hands. And can you?
Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm the site's managing editor, Matt Goldberg, and with me today is news editor Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
And associate editor Perry Nemiroff.
Hello.
Today we will be talking about the Divergent series, Insurgent, as well as the book, Insurgent, and we'll be going into spoilers on both. We will not say what happens in Allegiant, but in order to talk about the many differences between the movie and the book, we're going to go into depth about both rather than dance around spoilers. So if you've seen Insurgent but haven't read the book, or if you haven't seen Insurgent, basically if spoilers bother you, we'll see you next time. So let's dive in. I have not read Insurgent. I read Divergent. It was pretty close. The first movie seemed pretty close to the book.
Yeah.
The ending was changed a bit, and I felt that they removed the book's greatest asset, which is that the book is pretty dark. The book can be fairly brutal at times, and I think they softened up the movie. But I didn't like Divergent enough to be like, you know what, I want to go further, especially since I heard that the novels were diminishing returns. And I have yet to talk to a single person who's like, you know what, I like Allegiant. What I've heard unanimously on Allegiant is that it is fucking terrible. And so I didn't feel like, you know what, I want to keep reading to get to this book I'm going to dislike. So I quit after Divergent. I have gone into Insurgent not knowing the details of the plot of the book. As a movie, it was better than I thought it would be from Robert Schwentke and Akiva Goldsman as one of the writers, but that's not saying much. There was no magical space horse, so I guess there's that. I just don't care about Tris Prior. I don't care. I don't think she's a particularly interesting protagonist. She is that strain of protagonist who is special because she just is rather than what she does. And I feel that as an active character, she takes a back seat to Four, who's the one rallying the troops, making connections, being a leader. And she is just someone who is divergent, and then she has to do things that make her divergence in this film completely different than the last film. Am I misunderstanding that? Like, in the first movie, because she was divergent, she could understand that Sims weren't real, and that made her invulnerable to the Janine's evil plan. By the way, I still can't get on board with Janine as a villain name. It just isn't going to happen. In this one, though, it's like, no, actually, now she's divergent. That means she gets really into the Sims. I don't know. I had trouble with it. It feels like they changed what divergence means in the movies. Is that what happens in the books?
No, that's exactly what happens in the movie, though. The changes that they made when adapting it kind of completely flipped the whole meaning of being divergent and what makes it special or dangerous. It's almost like the opposite as presented in Insurgent.
Yeah, I mean, it's been a while since I saw Divergent, so I might be cross-contaminating here from the book. But basically, in the book, Divergent means just that, is that, like, she doesn't fit into one group. She carries traits from all the groups that can do all the things. It doesn't really, like, the fact that she can realize that she's in a sim is just a side effect of being divergent. It isn't being divergent. And so I can't remember if that's how it was in the movie or not.
In the movie, like, divergence is treated like, here's the thing, the notion of divergence doesn't even really make any fucking sense, because the notion is that you are not placed in a faction. The test suggests a faction, but you're going to choose it no matter what.
Yeah.
So already that doesn't really work. If she were forced to be in a faction and therefore knew that actually she could belong to multiple factions, that would be interesting. But ultimately, it's like, you could go either way. It's like, okay, well, I'll go to this one. And I think there's the idea that someone who is divergent can subvert the system, but in the way it's presented in the movie, the only reason she can subvert the system is she can actually just subvert a hallucination. She's not going to be like, hey, everyone, you don't have to belong to one faction. That's not what she's doing. All she's doing is showing that she will happen to be invulnerable when the evil mastermind plan comes to be.
Well, that's
a big thing that isn't clear in an Insurgent, and especially with some of the other characters, like Naomi Watts' character, that is so underwritten, it's really disappointing, because that was one of the most interesting parts of the book, is seeing her and her mentality about what it means to be in a faction and how she feels about the whole faction system going up against Janine Matthews' idea of the whole system. And they're two warring factions, I guess, and they both have completely different perspectives on the entire system and want different futures. And that was interesting until they kind of sucked all that out of the other character.
Yeah, that just doesn't exist in the movie. And to me, it kind of feels like, I mean, after seeing that big change, because Perry's right, I think her name is Evelyn, is a major part of the book in that...
That's Naomi Watts' character, Evelyn.
Yeah, Evelyn basically represents a different way of ruling whatever this post-Wasteland Chicago. So it becomes a power struggle of, like, you know, she doesn't think that factions are necessary. She doesn't think they're useful. She thinks the factionless should, you know, rule or whatever. I can't remember correctly. And so there's a power struggle there, and that's really interesting, but that's not in the movie. But I'm thinking that maybe that the sense of Legion is two movies, which doesn't make sense. The book is terrible. It doesn't make sense, but seeing how underwritten Evelyn is in this movie, maybe they're just going to push that plot line into Allegiant Part 1 in order to flesh it out and give it story.
The best part about Evelyn in the book was that she was manipulative, and then they didn't really... In the movie, at least, I mean, she is manipulative, but it's kind of something that they throw in at the very end by what she does at the very end of the film. It's like, oh, look at what she's capable of. She didn't really mean all that all along. But in the book, it's kind of weaved throughout the entire story. And that's where Marcus comes in as well. Ray Stevenson's character, who was essentially written out of the entire movie.
Yeah.
I think he's in like 3 minutes of this movie.
That's the other difference that's hugely disappointing, because what happens is in the book is that so clearly Evelyn is manipulative, and she's ruthless in her manipulation. Like, she loves her son, but she is willing to forego certain things for the greater good, essentially. So Marcus, if you'll remember, Marcus, Ray Stevens' character, is Four's father. Abusive. Heavily abusive, doesn't like him, whatever. What happens in the books is that Triss ends up teaming up with Marcus for the big third act to go and we'll get to this because we'll get to this in a second because there's another huge major change. But basically, Triss teams up with Marcus in order to do something, and that represents, in Four's eyes, a betrayal on her part. And so there's an inherent drama and inherent conflict there in their relationship, because Triss is teaming up with Marcus. Marcus is the person who beat Four when he was a child, and Four can't see past that, whereas Triss is trying to think about the greater good and what is necessary to happen in order to put a stop to Janine.
That was one of the best elements of the book, too, because that's something that's so different from every other YA franchise out there, where we're always complaining about the same old love triangles and relationships and things like that. In the book for Insurgent, he was threatening to break up with her, and we never really see that. Yeah. And she, like, just calling her out on being completely selfish and stubborn, and it's, you know, it's in this crazy world, in this crazy situation, but those were very real things that I was able to connect to, and that is just not present in the movie at all. They're kind of both on this perfect, we're going to live happily ever after together track, except for the fact that Janine's trying to destroy everything.
Yeah. Well, and the like, massive change from the book to the movie. So in the movie, Janine has this device, and if you unlock this device, it has a secret in it. And in order to unlock the device, you have to test people, and they have to, you know, you have to have someone that can pass the simulations for all five factions or whatever. In the book, this device does not exist. These tests do not exist. This is not a thing. In the book, Janine basically just wants Triss back because in Divergent, Triss was not susceptible to the simulation. So Janine is like, I have a problem. I can't control Divergence. I want to figure out how to control them. So basically, she wants Triss to come in so she can figure out how to control her.
Oh, it's so ridiculous. The second I saw that box in the trailer, I'm like, holy shit, that's it. It's over. They ruined it. But like, well, at the same time, I think that the box didn't work really at all in the movie. But while watching the things with the box unfold in context, I do see why they did it. Because otherwise, there'd kind of be no forward momentum to the movie, no goal, really. Like, the book doesn't really have a goal. They're kind of just existing in this world, and Janine's kind of like the puppet master, and whatever happens to Triss is kind of her doing. So in the book, it gives them all something to work towards in a way. It's just stupid, and it looks stupid, too. Like, that whole contraption that jabs her and puts her in the simulation.
You mean the Matrix wires?
It's ridiculous looking. Wires.
It was clear that they had to do it in order to, you know, book to film. Basically, you know, essentially from the moment they hired Robert Schwenke, I'm sure that they were like, listen, Divergent did okay. We can do better at the box office. Let's try and ramp up the action. How do we ramp up the action? Let's create a situation in which we can get some really cool set pieces. And then thus the box is born and the simulations are born.
Well, yeah, I'm sorry. Go on, Perry.
I will say, though, that action sucked, the box, but there was a lot of great hand-to-hand grounded combat that I really appreciated. But that probably is going off topic. So, Matt, why don't you pick up where you left off?
Well, I was just going to say a few things. Visually, I do... It was better than I expected because I've seen Schwenke's previous films, R.I.P.D. and Red, look terrible, and Red is enjoyable because of the cast, not the action. Insurgent looks good. I kind of liked all the shattered glass stuff. I thought there were some interesting angles. It's silly and it's indulgent and it doesn't really work outside of that, but it's pretty enough. Going back to what you said with Evelyn, I was gonna say, you know, you guys are saying that she plays a much larger role in the book. It's much more manipulative. And this is something where I'm left to wonder, and this doesn't just pertain to Evelyn. You cast Naomi Watts and you cast Octavia Spencer, and they do nothing. They are so wasted in this film. By the way, kudos to Kate Winslet for picking up a paycheck for standing in one room for the entire film. And seriously, like this series, what you guys are saying, it sounds like, again, very... not having any regrets about not reading the book. But my feeling here is that by making such a large leap from the source material, I don't know who they're trying to please, because now they're just going to piss off the fans, the ones who are on board no matter what. And as someone who's not a fan, I wasn't wooed by this. I mean, ramping up the action didn't change anything. What I wanted to do is care more about Triss. She's the protagonist. And right now, all Divergent looks like is the series that makes Hunger Games look better by comparison. Like, this is the function of the Divergent series.
Yeah, I wonder what's going to happen with the box office from here. I feel like it's just going to be such a significant drop-off, and they're going to have no choice but to combine the last two films, and I feel like that's why we're going to end up with a Hunger Games spinoff. Because, I mean, what's going to happen to Lionsgate without Hunger Games? And now that this is going to... this is going to piss off a lot of fans, because I've kept in touch with a lot of
Dread 2. No, I'm kidding. I don't give a shit about Dread 2.
I've kept in touch with a lot of the YA fan sites, and most of the people I spoke to aren't just, like, disappointed. They're angry. It's like the few redeeming qualities the second book had, they just completely stripped away. And we never even talked about that stupid scanner. That was my least favorite part of the movie. Oh, yeah. That was the thing that made me angrier than anything, because that right there is the ultimate, like, let's make this even flashier and try to make it look more expensive for no reason whatsoever. That is the stupidest thing I've ever seen, and it reduces the whole faction testing that we saw in the first film to absolutely nothing. If you could hold up a scanner to any citizen's face and all of a sudden their faction pops up, like, why didn't they just use that to begin with?
That's the thing. It's so ridiculous that it's like, well, you just negated an entire film's worth.
Wait. I will allow that, because I am willing to say maybe that was invented after the events of the first film. That maybe that the testing, that did not exist before, so they couldn't use it until now. So testing is irrelevant.
If you want to talk about technology, and we're going to spoiler territory now if you haven't seen the movie, which we already have gone into spoiler territory, but so the box that supposedly exists, that you can only open by hooking someone up to a simulation with fiber optic wires, has apparently been there for 200 years. How did 200 years ago they say, oh yeah, they'll have fiber optic technology to open this box? That just
That's part of the experiment, Adam.
It's part of the experiment.
I did keep wondering how Janine even figured out how to activate the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, because in
she's
the book,
she's super smart. She's erudite.
And then, if we want to pick it apart even further, why did Triss get a do-over? Does the box allow for do-overs? Because that's not fair.
Well, and it's more power. The box's secret is more powerful in the book, because in the book, the video file that's in the box from the movie, is in Janine's possession, and that's the thing that Triss and Marcus are after. They want to get into her computer and get this thing that's secret. They don't know what it is. In the book, Janine has seen this video, knows what it is. It makes her more manipulative, because she, you know, has seen this and is scared of it and wants to keep everyone quiet, and you know that makes it more interesting, as opposed to in the movie where, you know, she has no idea and it's just like, oh no, whoa, what's this, what's going on? And in the book, she orders Triss's execution because she tries to test her to see if she can control Divergence. It's not working. She's too resistant. And basically, Janine is like, all right, kill her. Like, whatever. She's not upset. Like, she doesn't need her, and just orders her execution. And then Peter, you know, does the fake killing and all that stuff. But it just, she's much more of like a cold-hearted villain in that regard, and that she's just kind of like, you know, on to the next one. Gonna figure out, you know, what I'm doing. Which makes her a more interesting villain, as opposed to just, you know, this lady who's trying to open this box.
Yeah, I've heard someone said like Janine's the banality of evil. I'm like, no, she's just, you know, banal.
Yeah.
Like, that's the thing. Like, she's just a bland fucking character, and that's really all there is to it. It's sort of, I really don't know how else to put it. She's like, Kate Winslet just doesn't even seem to be that into it.
Like, I think she's like, fine. I think she's like, I mean, I signed up for it. It's whatever.
She signed up for it, but I mean, this is not. We can get more from Kate Winslet.
Yeah. I was busy wondering while I was doing that Insurgent Shatter Reality experience how they possibly got her to stand in and do the video necessary for that. And then after seeing the movie, all of a sudden I realized she just stands in the same room from start to finish. So they just shot it in there.
They're like, yeah, oh, she was already there. 4 minutes. Well, and so here's my theory of what happened to this franchise and you know, what went wrong and why all these changes and everything. So when Divergent was greenlit, when they started production on Divergent, only Divergent and Insurgent had come out. And Matt, you've read Divergent. Like, it's fine. It's not the greatest book in the world, but it's interesting enough.
To the end.
Yeah, and there's potential for, like, you know, maybe an interesting franchise there. And so they make that movie, and Perry and I did the set visit for the movie together. And, you know, we were like, oh, you know, have you heard anything about the third book? Asking Neil Berger, the director. It's much more.
I've heard it's great. Nod and smile.
Well, and it basically, we were like, no. You know, is Veronica Roth telling you things so you know how to plan and stuff? You know, and he's like, you know, she told me a few things. And so they produced Divergent. They produced the first movie. They've got this franchise. Allegiant comes out. Allegiant is terrible. And Allegiant, like, reveals, you know, all of the secrets of the franchise and everything, and it's awful. And so my theory is that they saw Allegiant and they were like, fuck, like, we made this franchise. How do we turn that book into, like, a satisfying conclusion to this film series? And so, you know, Matt, you were complaining about Octavia Spencer not being in the movie enough, and Naomi Watts. Those two characters play major roles in the story of Divergent over there. The power struggle. Basically, a power vacuum happens, which, I mean, you've seen Insurgent, Janine is gone. So a power vacuum occurs, and these leaders, you know, come together with differing opinions of how to proceed. So I think that'll come into play more. I think basically they were like, Allegiant sucks. Let's maybe cut Insurgent in half, kind of, and move some of that
cut
power
Insurgent
struggle
story into third.
Yeah.
Basically.
Because there are two Allegiant movies, because Allegiant is, again, I cannot stress this enough, Allegiant is a really bad book. And a lot of it takes place in like fluorescent lit rooms. And so I guess my thinking is that they were just like, you know, we can't do two movies of that. We can't even do one movie of that. Let's move some of this power
struggle. We can't even do 30 minutes of that.
Yeah, let's move it. But I mean, the way that Insurgent ends, and I'm not going to go into Allegiant spoilers, but Perry, like, I have no, like literally like the last few moments of Insurgent, it's just kind of like, I don't know how they go to Allegiant from there, because that fundamentally
changes. I couldn't figure
it out. Yeah, it fundamentally changes what happens in Allegiant.
There's also so many loose ends. It's not even just about the cliffhanger. It's about all of these characters that they introduced and then lost. It's, I mean, I'm wondering, you know, what happened to Caleb? What happened to Marcus? And then there's all the other ones that weren't in the last film that they suddenly introduced. There's Uriah and who does Brenda Salazar play again? Who's Rosa?
I just
combined her name from two different YA movies, by the way. Rosa Salazar plays Brenda in The Maze Runner, but who does she play in this?
I don't even know. Some girl. Lynn is her character's name, it says.
It's like, why bother introducing all those characters when we already have, you know, Maggie Q, who needed more screen time. And
yeah.
And even someone like Mekhi Phifer. Actually, you know what? The one thing that I really like in this movie was what they did with Jai Courtney's character.
Were you going to say that you liked that he got shot in his gigantic head?
I just thought he was, like, he was actually scary. And it looked like he was giving 100%. Like, when he was running through that field, chasing them towards the train, like, God, like, he just was putting everything into that sprint. And he was actually kind of threatening.
Yeah, I would agree with that. In a movie that's, like, devoid of threatening presences, the Jai Courtney's character was at least, it was kind of like, you know, this guy's an asshole, and if they get caught, that'd probably be bad news. Whereas, like, Janine, it's like, what? I don't really know what she's doing. Like,
yeah. Oh, and
caught,
then there's Johnny Jai Weston's Court character, who they just pulled out of nowhere and gave him a name.
Yeah. Jai Courtney, I will say this. Jai Courtney, I believed he would shoot a child. I will say that about his portrayal of Eric. I do believe he would kill a child.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. I would also say that this film, not only is it clearly sloppy on these big levels in terms of adapting the book, just not having read the book, there are just these moments in Insurgent where I'm just sitting there, I'm like wondering, like, am I the only one wondering, like, how do you watch this film and say, oh yeah, that makes sense? For instance, all the Divergents who have all the Dauntless who have split from their faction and are now hiding underground, and hiding underground means hanging out on the front steps of Kandor.
Yeah,
that's going underground. Or the little nanobots that, like, you know, I will kill three more people every day. I'm like, just let me get this straight. You have a mind control bot. You can't just turn them all on and overpower your protagonist. Like, you can't just pick her up and frickin' carry her there. Like, is this really that hard to figure out? Like, it's just sloppy storytelling again and again, where things are just like, how did you not pick up on? Or, like, at the end of the film where they're all like, I can say the end of Insurgent, right? The way the movie ends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a spoiler podcast.
It was all a big experiment. Thanks for watching The Maze Runner. seriously, I was watching, like, man, Maze Runner only came out, like, in September, you know? Like, people went to see The Maze Runner. I liked The Maze Runner, much to my own surprise.
I promise you, the second book of The Maze Runner series is much better than this one.
Okay, good to know.
I've heard the third book is good, too.
I like it. So I'm actually halfway through it now, and I like it a lot.
Good. Well, there's one YA franchise that won't shit the bed.
Didn't like The Maze Runner, but hopefully the second movie will get me on board.
Let me rephrase. I have now, as opposed to the Divergent series, I have now heard someone say something positive about the
about
third
the
book in the Maze Runner series. I have heard it gets better. But this one, okay, so Insurgent ends, and it's like, someone comes along, it's like, sorry, everyone, you know, your entire fucking existence, and your father's existence, and your father, just everything, your entire society, it was just an experiment. You can go beyond the wall now, and everyone's like, huh, how about that? And they just start wandering off.
Like, well, that's another, because that's very different from the book.
very different.
Yeah. Well, that's
that's the big thing I can't quite wrap my head around.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I guess I can say the message that she leaves in the book, because it's not super different. But basically, instead of saying, "Listen, this was an experiment," she says, "The world has gone to shit and is terrible. We're trying this experiment as a last ditch effort." So basically, it's like whenever it's revealed that like you can go outside the walls, everyone is like, "Well, I don't know what the fuck's out there," because like this message has been here and like the world was terrible back then. So who knows what's out there?
Right, exactly.
And that's what it is in the book. And so when it was in the movie, when she was like, "Experiment, you know, everything's good," and then like everyone, like after decades of like separation and stuff, it's everyone's magically together and happy and la la la.
Yeah, like I just don't buy this. By the way, it's like, I guess with Janine, they just threw her in a tower and like locked her in a tower and threw away the key and like, okay, well then that worked out. Like, I mean, I'm also not exactly clear. Like, Janine has, like, some kind of power. Like, I don't understand. I'm still not exactly sure why Dauntless would be like, "Yeah, we'll follow you." Like, Janine's sort of, like, in charge, but all of her... Why would Dauntless just not
Dauntless
take her
are supposed to be, like, the stupid jocks. You know?
I
like,
understand
they
they're
have
supposed
no
to
brains.
Be the stupid
they,
jocks,
they
but, like, military
coup.
Yeah, but military coups happen. They're the ones with all the guts. And it's not like Janine's a charismatic figure. Again, she is someone who spends the entire film in a room in front of a computer. Like, this is our villain. you know, whereas, like, again, if we're gonna, like, I'll bring in the Hunger Games comparisons. Donald Sutherland, great villain. Just very quietly threatening. He does things. He sends out video broadcasts. He talks to people. He, you know, has like some dark secrets. Like, this is a bad dude, and you can understand, like, oh, this is how he wields power. Janine is like, okay, so you know how there's like a real villain in movies, and then there's the evil scientist who works for the evil person. Janine is the evil scientist. She is not the top tier. She works for someone, and you don't put her in charge because she only has one fucking job, and yet somehow she's like, "And I can declare martial law now." Why can you do this thing?
I think it goes back to just poor source material. I mean, when you look at the Hunger Games, I mean, even if Mockingjay is not great, those books thematically are pretty rich. And it just needed, you know, people to the film adaptations of the Hunger Games, I think, are not only some of the best like YA adaptations, but some of the best sci-fi films of the past decade or even, you know, half century maybe. I think those are really interesting, and it starts with that source material and a really strong foundation, which you don't have in Divergent. There's nothing to build on because the subtext is just not there.
That's what happened with the books. They had this great core concept that was super interesting that could sustain one book, and then there was just nowhere to go with it. They couldn't, they just couldn't figure out what she couldn't figure out what to do with it.
Yeah,
because the
second two books
are not interesting at all.
Yeah, I think Legion is proof that she had no idea where she was going and didn't have the talent to come up with a good place to go. Like, it's fine not knowing where you're going at the beginning. It's probably not a great idea to do that with a book trilogy.
The sad thing is, I'm sure she was forced into it in a way. They're like, here's your paycheck, give us the book by this date, no matter what. And that's why we have ended up with Insurgent and Allegiant.
Enjoy being in your early 20s.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's something where I just feel like this is... I understand everyone's looking for the next big YA thing, and they're going to keep looking for it. I think Divergent is sort of... The thing about Divergent is it's just mediocre enough to survive. Like, it's not a total train wreck like the Mortal Instruments, where like someone makes out with someone who could be their brother, and everyone's like, "Yeah, okay." You know, all right. That's the way the movie ends. It's like, you know what? I don't feel like we're siblings. Oh, okay. Well, if only there were some genetic test that
could figure easily this out. One of the worst YA adaptations of like the last 4 or 5 years, by far. And apparently that TV show is still happening.
Well, and yet we have stuff like Beautiful Creatures and Vampire Academy that are really good that just don't take off. Like, we don't get the ones we deserve. Like, if you're
Vampire
looking for the next
Academy
one,
was a pretty big bummer.
Yeah,
wait,
I mean,
really? I mean, wait, like, the movie's a bummer, or is it a bummer it didn't go...
That that it didn't get a little more attention, because I think the reason that that was so poorly reviewed was because Weinstein Company kind of buried it. They didn't screen it for anybody, so they left everyone with the assumption that it was shit, and then it came out, and, you know, the reviews pretty much reflected that nobody saw the movie. That was one of the worst marketing campaigns I've ever seen.
Yeah, I thought it was a TV show. I thought it was like a CW show. Someone would say, like, no, that's a movie.
It's got that kind of vibe. It definitely has that kind of vibe to it, but it's not a bad movie by any means.
No, it isn't. I would say it's a film that's like, if I had to put it on the level, I would say it's like, imagine if Sorcerer's Stone was the end of the Harry Potter series, because Sorcerer's Stone is not a great film. Like, you know, it has potential to be better for better future movies.
Yeah.
But it, as a series, it wasn't there yet.
And it's too bad, because that was a cool second book, too. A book that took all those characters and kind of brought them to a new location, and in that way, like, branching out beyond the school kind of built the world in a really interesting way. So, we'll never see it. I think they tried to kickstart it, and it failed.
That's a bummer. Well, and then you have Warner Brothers, like, tried really hard with Beautiful Creatures, and for whatever reason, well, I think because they weren't marketing, like, I went to see it, and I was shocked, because I was like, wait, this is told from the guy's point of view? Like, that's interesting, because most YA is female point of view. That's an interesting angle, which they hid in all the marketing. They were just trying to get that Twilight crowd or something, and that's not the movie that it is. They were marketing a different movie than it actually was.
I mean, this is sort of the trick of, this is sort of the challenging thing of being a studio and being a follower, because the challenge here is, okay, I have to market something, and I need to market it so that it reminds people of the thing that they like. The problem is that the thing that they like now becomes the standard, and you have to prove you're not off-brand Cheerios. Like, that's what you have to now say. It's like, hey, you like this thing? Here's this other thing that's like that, but not as good. And so when you sell it something one way, or you sell it as a comparison and it's not that at all. So you have a Beautiful Creatures and you make people think it's Twilight when actually it's not really Twilight at all. And again, the film isn't perfect, but it doesn't get to exist on its own terms. And if you let these movies exist on their own terms, they at least look intriguing. But from a marketing perspective, you don't want someone to have, oh, I have the first Beautiful Creatures. What I have is the next Twilight.
I feel like it's a vicious cycle, though. What movie at this point on the studio level exists on its own terms? There's always something people are comparing it to.
Well, exactly. And it has to sort of be, and to me, what it has to do is it has to be something where you just break from it completely, or no one has really seen it. So, you know, Hunger Games. Before Hunger Games came out, people who had no familiarity with it were like, yeah, I've seen Battle Royale. I've seen Battle Royale, and there's some Twilight love triangle shit in there. The Twilight stuff is not there. It's not Twilight. Twilight had just become synonymous with YA love triangles, and Hunger Games still doesn't really even have that much of a love triangle. And yeah, there's Battle Royale, but a lot of people haven't seen Battle Royale. You know, movie nerds have, but not all the teenagers who funded Hunger, you know, who made Hunger Games a blockbuster. Yeah. So Hunger Games really gets to exist on its own. Harry Potter gets to exist on its own. These franchises, it's very hard to be first. And keep in mind, also, you have to have, like, the worldwide bestseller success. And then the movie has to be good. Like, it doesn't surprise me that 50 Shades of Grey was able to pull in a big opening weekend, just as it doesn't surprise me that it plummeted 75% on its second weekend.
Well, that's why I'm really pulling for the Southern Reach trilogy, which a lot of people haven't read. It's like eco-horror. Like, it doesn't exist. It's a horror story, but, like, it involving, like, environments. It's really weird. And Alex Garland, who just directed Ex Machina and is getting
Everyone says it's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, he's attached to write and direct the first book of that, and that's something where, like, you can't point to it and say this is like this or this is like that. It's not like anything. So if someone would give it a chance, and if a studio gives it the backing, like, right now he's just attached, who knows if it will come to fruition, but that's something that's interesting and new and different. But you're at the starting gate. Like, trying to get someone on board with that is really tough, because it's hard to explain, and you can't say it's like this, because it's not like anything.
Should keep an eye on the fifth wave also. I'm telling you, that's going to be different. The only thing that has me worried about that one is Chloe Moretz being in it, because for some reason I see her face and her name, and I'm like, oh, that's cliche garbage, even though I don't really know what I'm connecting it to. But that book's like a pretty fresh feeling scenario that does not have your typical cheesy love triangle. So
it's, I mean, they're marketing it from well over a year out, so they definitely want that to be their, you know, I forget whose movie that is.
Sony.
They definitely want that to be a thing.
Yeah.
And raise awareness as soon as possible. So, I mean, it's dark. I mean, what I've read about it is it sounds just fucking, it reminded me of How I Live Now, reading the synopsis. And boy, was that a cheery time at the movies.
Well, the book is pretty dark. It's kind of like, it gives you this no way out feeling, and everyone's so miserable in it. But I swear it was a fun read.
Okay, then. Well, I mean, that's...
I think it's telling that we're on a podcast about Insurgent and we're finding ways to not talk about Insurgent.
Because Insurgent's so forget. Here's the thing. At the end of the day, the Divergent series will be an also-ran.
Yeah.
I mean, that's it. Because, what, Schwenke's directing Allegiance, right? He's directing the...
Yeah, he's Allegiance attached to the first one. I'm sure they'll get another journeyman to do the second one, just so they can get him done, bam, bam. Yeah. And I'm sure Woodley and everybody is like, all right, when are we done? Like, you're taking up, like, 6 months of my year.
By the way, I would like to say, the one person who I still... I've enjoyed immensely in both films is Miles Teller.
Yeah. Because he just doesn't care.
He can do anything with garbage dialogue. It's incredible.
He really can. He really can. And he just really knocks it out of the park. But yeah, the Divergent series will be, this was a thing that existed. And I'll say this, though. You know, I mean, yeah, Beautiful Creatures and Vampire Academy, they're not going to make any more of those. But those are going to be movies that I still will reference in the future.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to like say like, oh man, you got to check out this film. Like, I'm not going to go say like Vampire Academy is a cult classic, you know, and just give it time. But what I am going to say is this is a good film and I wish more people had seen it. Divergent series is like, people saw this, it was number one at the box office the weekends that it opened, and the end. It is ultimately, it may get four movies, but I almost kind of see it as just the same as Mortal Instruments. It's a thing that existed and just as forgettable.
Yeah, that's probably right.
I will add that the movie is mildly entertaining, though. Like,
yeah,
as much as I'm picking it apart, it was a 2-hour movie and I never really got bored once. I didn't really care about what was happening, but I was semi-entertained.
I agree with that. I was not bored. That is really low bar. When I say it out loud,
one heck of a poll quote.
Really, it's like, I was not bored. Matt Goldberg, Collider. Put it on the box.
It was very much, I mean, it's clear that it was made with the intention of reaching the widest audience. I was talking to people after I saw it afterwards about the differences between this and Hunger Games. And, you know, the first Hunger Games movie, when it came out, like, that opening weekend was insane. That was ridiculous for a non-3D, non-IMAX release. That was nuts. And, I mean, it helps that they got someone like Gary Ross to shepherd that, a guy who's, you know, super creative and super into it. But the fact that it did so well afforded them the opportunity to kind of go their own way on the next films. Now, I'm not saying that Lionsgate was like, do whatever you want. But, you know, producer Nina Jacobson, they had kind of their pick of the litter when, you know, pulling together directors. They met with Bennett Miller. They met with Cary Fukunaga.
I mean, they were under a time constraint.
They were under a time constraint. When I'm talking creatively, like the ability to, you know, they expanded. And again, the foundation is better inherently. But they expanded the scope, but they kept it very creatively interesting. They didn't lose any of the thematic stuff that made it really compelling as... you know, as dystopian sci-fi and as something that, you know, it has a feeling of one of those 70s thrillers and stuff, because it's dealing with larger issues in addition to dealing with the stuff that's on the page. Then you look at something that like Divergent, which opens and does okay. It's mediocre. And that probably meant that after that came out, the studio was like, all right, guys, what can we do to make this reach like get more general audience appeal as opposed to saying, you know, go your own way, make something interesting, make something different. It was, you know, we got to hit this demographic. We had this percentage of males. We need to hit this number, so we need to grow it by this many, you know, stuff like that.
I mean, really, and the thing is for all of that trying, it did the exact same numbers.
Yeah.
And you did all these same numbers, and now you're committed to two more movies that no one's like, oh man, I gotta see where this
goes. And this one costs more to make too, so it doesn't even matter.
Yeah, the budget was like a lot more, and I'm sure
it's like 30 million more or something, I think.
And yet I'm not really seeing it on the screen.
No.
I mean, yeah, the special effects are slightly better, but I was never like, oh man, wow, what a expensive movie.
Like, well, they kind of shot themselves in the foot with that marketing campaign, though. Like, I really do think that first teaser trailer ruined that part of the movie for me. Because the second I saw that house take off, I'm like, fuck this movie. That's not what I signed up to see.
I did not sign up for flying houses, damn it.
Flying house and Ghost Ashley Judd.
That is like one of the worst sequences.
It was just so pointless. I saw that in the trailer and I was like, get the fuck out of here. I was like, that's stupid. And I don't care because it's clearly a dream or a simulation and it's not real. So I don't care.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it was...
This isn't Tom Cruise hanging off the side of an airplane. Let's be real.
That I want to see.
It was also such ridiculous action, too. Like, the way she moves around in that sequence almost feels like, you know, how a kid would wave around an action figure.
Yeah, I don't think she...
doesn't make any sense.
And look, I like Shailene Woodley a lot, but that being said, I do not think she is a credible action hero. Like, the way she screams and yells, it's too jarring.
Yeah.
I was fairly underwhelmed. I think she's a great actress, but also when looking back at Divergent, the choices she makes, I just don't think they're the right choices. I'm glad that she makes them, and that's not to say she's a bad actress. She's committing, but what she's committing to, I don't feel is the best place for the character to go. And so it's not like I'm writing her off, but I think that I'm not exactly excited to see her play this character for two more movies.
Yeah.
Like, and that's the thing. When I walked out of, like, you know, when I walked out of In Search, I'm like, I have two more of these?
Well, think how...
I have to do two more?
I was about to say, think how she feels. Like, think how that cast feels. Like, these aren't...
Well, that cast gets to be in... gets to... Yeah, but those movies are technically hits. Like, they're movies that, like, you could put their names next to it and be like... They are in this. Well, great. Well, then that means Shailene Woodley gets to do something else in her time. It's a good career move for her. It's just like, it's your chore. It's a chore, you know?
Yeah.
You clearly, like, you don't get a sense that anyone there is enjoying themselves.
How weird for Miles Teller to, like, if Fantastic Four takes off, he's like, oh, yeah, I'm the lead in, like, a superhero franchise, but I have to come back and be, like, third build. Whatever.
Well, he's already talked shit about the Divergent franchise, hasn't he?
Didn't
piss fans off? I forget what he said. He said now.
Wait, he pissed his fans off?
Yeah, he said something nasty about the Divergent series, and like all the fans went crazy.
Yeah, he basically said that shooting Insurgent was like a chore, and it was bad for his soul or something because it was so bad. But
he did it for the money or something.
Yeah,
something about a paycheck.
Yeah,
damn you and your audience honesty, Teller. Smile and nod, you son of a bitch.
Teller's a straight shooter, and he's not even like he's not a cinephile. Like, we were there on set, and I think someone asked him about movies, and he was like, "Yeah, I've never seen Star Wars or anything." Like, he's like, "I just like to hang out with my buddies." Like, he doesn't really care about movies, which is funny. Like, he's a talented guy, and he makes interesting choices, but I just don't think any of it bothers him. And then he's like, ah, sure, Fantastic Four.
You know, that's the thing, though. I think you can enjoy acting without actually being a cinephile. And I know that sounds weird, but there are a lot of actors who won't see the movies they're in.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Which I think can be weird at times. Like, if you see yourself, like, acting, you become really self-conscious about it. Like, you go to the premiere, and then you're like, okay. So, yeah, I gotta say, it's something where I'm sure... some of these people will go on to do better things. Not so sure about Theo James, who is pretty much inoffensive, is what I would say about him.
Yeah, he's fine.
He's fine. He's a guy that's there. He's handsome.
He's a nice guy. Hopefully he gets something that is interesting to do. I just don't think any of these characters are interesting. So, like, you put someone as talented as Shailene Woodley as Triss, and it's just, it's not good, and it doesn't really make them shine or anything. Miles Teller shines playing a dick because he doesn't care. He plays a character who doesn't care.
It's not a stretch for him.
Yeah,
it's not a stretch for the Teller.
Ansel Elgort. I think he's a great actor, and he just got nothing in this movie. Like, he just mopes around, and there's almost like there's no thought behind any of the decisions he makes. So it's like he makes this life-changing decision, and you're like, wait, why'd you do that?
There's one moment that where he does something that's really interesting, and it doesn't follow up on that. And that's on the train where he's like, you know what? Maybe I will let my sister get murdered. And it's not because he's afraid to do anything. He consciously could have done something, and he decides to see how it plays out.
Yeah.
And I thought that was really cool and something they could definitely have built on, and then it just doesn't do anything.
That's kind of his arc in the book, is that he's just kind of
he's on the edge of interesting.
Well, no, I'm sure that's alluding to stuff in Allegiant, and I can't remember correctly, but it does become a thing where he's just kind of like a dick, and Triss is, you know, nice, and it's like, you know, do I want to forgive my brother for, you know, letting me die, basically? Because that thing on the train happens where he's just kind of like, yeah, just kind of sits to the side. But again, in the movie, they don't follow up on it at all. It's not like, hey, you were going to let me die. Is that something we should talk about?
No, he's like, no, I'm just going to go my own way now.
And she doesn't even give it a second thought. She just, sound goes in the other direction.
There's so many moments in this movie where, having read the book, I was like, oh, okay, yeah, I know what's coming. Like, the first, I think it's like the second scene, Ray Stevenson was there. I was like, oh, yeah, all right, got to get ready to see a lot of him in this movie. And then the Caleb thing on the train, I was like, oh, yeah, that's, you know, that stuff's coming. And then I forget that it doesn't happen. And then after the movie, I was like, oh, shit. Like, I remember sitting there watching Ray Stevenson thinking I'm going to see a lot of him in this movie, and then he didn't come back.
It's like the same Marcus thing with Uriah when he was on the roof with her. And I'm like, oh, great, now he's in the movie. And then all of a sudden he was gone.
I was like, there's Uriah. But I mean, as soon as they left Uriah out of the first movie, it was pretty much gone.
But why introduce him at all now? They even gave him a damn character poster. And he's kind of like Ray Stevenson. He's in the movie for 5 minutes.
Why, Adam?
Well, I can't say without spoiling Allegiant.
Yeah, that's why.
And it's going
to
be
cheap. And
I'm sure
it was also done to make fans happy, too, because when he wasn't in the movie, tons of people were like, where is he? Where is he? Bring him out. So they probably just did it to hype people up.
Yeah. Shut up, fans. Here's your Uriah. He will have 4 lines now to deal with. Because, you know, they've got, like, Kate Winslet to deal with and Mekhi Phifer to deal with and, like, Maggie Q. They're like, oh, we forgot Zoe Kravitz is here, too.
Oh, Maggie Q really needed more in this movie. Because, like, what happens to Tori is so interesting in the book, and it's gone. It's, all of it's gone.
Yeah, because in the book, Tori wants to kill Janine, so it becomes, there's a struggle there, and, like, Tori is trying to kill Janine. There's a fight with Triss. All gone. Basically, all of the drama is gone. There's no drama in the movie. It's just action.
And it's the same thing with Sookie Waterhouse's character, where it was a big deal that Triss saved one over the other, and that's not addressed
that.
At all.
Oh, yeah. I totally forgot about that. When the person jumps off the cliff, it's like, it's a big deal that Triss saved Zoe Kravitz's character in the book. And so I guess you're alluding to Sookie Waterhouse's character is the girl who died's sister.
It was like the little boy and the sister, and I think she saves, like, one person saves the little boy and not her and lets her fall, and, like, the friend gets upset or something.
Yeah, it's like, why didn't you save my sister? And that's a thing that happens in the book.
Because I only have 2 fucking hands.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, Allegiant. let's look forward to
let's
to
do
the
it again next year.
Let's look forward to the good ones. Let's look, because I'm excited. I didn't think I would be, but I'm interested. I'm interested for the Scorch trials, and I very interested to see how Hunger Games finishes out.
Yeah,
so
I'm with you on that.
Because that's this franchise is done. The Hunger Games franchise has done so well to, like, pleasantly surprise, and that, like, it's genuinely great, and, like, are they gonna fuck it up because the book's not good? So how are they gonna
deal
with
it? Will say that with the book, they have managed to so far salvage the book.
Yeah.
So far it has surpassed the book. That being said, the book does not get better as it goes along.
No.
So
I have faith. I did not have faith in Francis Lawrence, and Catching Fire ended up being my favorite you know, big studio release of that year. So,
yeah, no, I mean, they've definitely earned the benefit of the doubt, and that's why I'm interested to see it.
Be very curious.
Yeah. So, is there any other YA stuff coming out? Is there any?
Feels like it's kind of dried up a little bit.
I feel like there should be more this year. Well, there's yeah. there's Paper Towns, but that's not this kind of YA.
Yeah, that's the new kind of, like, maybe The Fault in Our Stars will kick off a new trend of character.
Me and Earl and the Dying Girl.
Yeah, character-centric stories where it's like, oh, character arcs happen, and it's interesting, as opposed to, like, this guy's a vampire supernatural being slash your brother.
In a simulation.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. All right. You guys got anything else to say, or should we move on to recommendations?
Ready to move
on. I'm good.
We're ready. Let's move on. All right, Perry, what do you got for us?
All right. I had to decide between two movies that I love a lot that came out last week, but I think I'm going to go with It Follows over Backcountry just because it's coming out as a wider release this week. I think it's expanding to some, what was it, like 1,200 theaters or something like that?
Yeah, 1,200 screens, which is, it's a huge deal because it was a VOD. Like, this is the first time a studio has, like, scrapped the VOD and been like, nope, going to theaters.
And they should, because it's an awesome movie, and it's actually kind of connects to what we were just talking with the YA franchise thing, where it's a horror movie, but it's kind of like nothing you've ever seen before. There's some familiar concepts in there that'll definitely draw horror lovers who are looking for very specific things in their movies, but then it has a lot of really unique qualities to it. It's directed by David Robert Mitchell, and it stars Micah Monroe as a young girl who is just looking to find love, and she wants to have a boyfriend. So she's all excited to have her big night out with this guy, and she sleeps with him. And after their night together, he tells her that he gave her an STD of sorts. And what this STD does to a person is, no matter where the person is, it, we're going to call it it. If you want to call it a monster, a ghost, I don't know, it's it. It is following you. So the thing is, you could run like miles and miles away, but no matter where you are, it will be following you in a straight line. And if it catches you, it will kill you. And if it kills you, then it goes back to the person who infected you. It's like just this brilliant idea that is absolutely fascinating. And David Robert Mitchell does some incredible things with the visuals to run with that story. I don't want to spoil anything, but there's a couple really neat camera tricks that he uses, and it's like really like slow moving things that shouldn't be scary at all, but because you know it's coming all the time, when he tilts the camera a certain way or looks in another direction, it's like you're always looking for it in the background, and it keeps you on edge from start to finish. And I'll admit, in the end, there's some logic issues, but that never took away from how much I enjoyed the film. It's just an incredibly unique movie, and it's probably one of the best movies, horror movies, that I've seen since The Babadook. I'd be really surprised if this fell out of my top five horror films of the year by the end of 2015.
Definitely something where I've heard great things about it, and I'm excited to see it for sure. Adam, what about you?
I am recommending Bloodline, which is Netflix's new drama series, and it's really, really good. This is from the same guys who did Damages. And the cast is Kyle Chandler, Linda Cardellini from Freaks and Geeks, Sam Shepard, Sissy Spacek, Chloe Sevigny, Norbert Leo Butz from Tony Award winner Norbert Leo Butz, and the crown jewel, Ben Mendelsohn, who you have probably seen in Place Beyond the Pines, Dark Knight Rises, Animal Kingdom. He's a scene stealer, fantastic. This show, he is the co-lead with Kyle Chandler, and it's basically his chance to shine, and he is incredible. The show is it's essentially a family drama. It's a twist on the family drama genre. And more than any other Netflix series thus far, this has been the one that I've needed to... I'm not a huge binge watcher. I don't really binge. Like, I'll watch House of Cards over the course of a week or two. But this is one that I felt the need to just watch one episode after the other, because, like Damages, every episode ends with kind of a cliffhanger or something really interesting or different or really foreboding. And also, like Damages, the show plays with structure. So the first episode opens with flashes of something that happens later on in the season. And so And it the show will periodically flash back to this period while it's in the present, bringing another sense of tension to the story, and it flashes to other time periods as well, again periodically throughout episodes. So it's you know, a sense of raising the tension, and basically is kind of like, you know, I know where I'm going, but I have no idea how I'm going to get there from where I am here because things are so different. The story follows the Rayburn family, which is a family that lives in the Florida Keys. The mother and father, Sam Shepard and Sissy Spacek, have been running a little inn in the Florida Keys for 45 years. It's very well populated. The family's famous in the town. And so the first episode opens on the night of their 45th anniversary celebration. And it also happens to be the night that their oldest brother, Danny, played by Ben Mendelsohn, returns home. And he brings with him trouble. And so everyone kind of has their secrets, and you're trying to figure out what the history of this family is as the show goes along. The drama is really interesting. The performances are fantastic, especially Mendelsohn. A couple of the characters are a little underwritten, which is a little disappointing. But Mendelsohn's character is tremendous, and this is really just a vehicle for him to shine. And I absolutely expect him to be at the forefront of the best actor in a drama series. Emmy conversation later this year, might even win, which would be fantastic. The show's shot in Florida as well, and it's dripping with atmosphere. It's not like one of those shows like Hawaii Five-0 where you're like, oh, it's Hawaii, I get it. Like, you feel the heat, you feel these people sweating. And it's really interesting. The character interactions are great. And Kyle Chandler, I mean, you can't beat it. The guy fielded like a million offers to come back to television after Friday Night Lights. You know, this is the one that caught on. And I really hope he gets a second season, because I've really enjoyed the first season so far. It's on Netflix now, the entire 13-episode first season. It is well worth your time. Some people have said it's slow. Maybe it's more of a slow burn, but it caught my attention from episode one and kept it like crazy. So I've been really, really eager to watch the next episode as quickly as possible. So it's called Bloodline. It's on Netflix. You should watch it because it's really good.
All right. I will be recommending Noah Baumbach's While We're Young. I am a new Noah Baumbach fan. His earlier films, I haven't seen all of them, but Squid and the Whale and Margot at the Wedding, these films did not do much for me. They just felt very sour. Like, they were perhaps accurate, but these were sort of just people I didn't want to spend time with, and the humor in them didn't really connect with me. But now he's moved to a happier place where his films are insightful, but they're also have a nice lighthearted touch to them. And so he has sort of hit on this kind of new trilogy right now of young people in New York, and it's Frances Ha, While We're Young, and Mistress America. Frances Ha was delightful. I think it seizes perfectly on what it's like being a post, someone who's just graduated college and has no idea what they're doing, and does so in a realistic but also very funny way. While We're Young, the film stars Ben Stiller and Naomi Watts. It's a childless couple. They're in their early 40s, and they've become disconnected from their friends who all have babies. Stiller plays a documentary filmmaker who's been, his character has been working on a documentary for the last 10 years. The documentary is clearly lousy, but he can't move forward on it, so he also teaches secondary learning. When old people learn, like, continuing education, nailed it. So he is teaching, and then in strolls another couple played by the incomparable Adam Driver and Amanda Seyfried. And Driver's character also wants to be a documentary filmmaker, and they're hipsters basically. But Watson Stiller's characters instantly connect with them, because they see this allure of youth, and they see these two young people who want to know more about them, but they also sort of become enamored of this youth culture that Stiller sees is all about process. And to me, what I think the film does brilliantly is that in some ways, yes, it's kind of like a midlife crisis movie, but what Baumbach does is he expands it to really make it a story about how you have two cultures. You have an older generation who's trying to chase what they had. And then you have a younger generation trying to create something they never had, and how nothing new is really being created here. And it's kind of absurd in its own way, but it's also slightly off-putting. It's a little creepy, but not in ways that are unsettling, except in how this is the way culture goes. It's not a film that will sicken you, but it is a film that's like, oh no, this is where we are. But he still manages to find comedy from it. It's a very thoughtful film. I've seen it twice now. I saw it at TIFF. I just saw it again tonight at the Atlanta Film Festival. It's really funny, and all the performances are great. It's a really smart film, and I highly recommend it. So it's While We're Young. It comes out soon. And well, I think it comes out in April. I think that's when it comes out.
It opens this weekend in limited release and then expands wide in April, yeah.
There
so
you go.
So the next few weeks, check your local listings. It's very good. I saw it too. I like it a lot.
Yeah.
It's very
I fun. Agree.
And Adam okay. Driver is amazing.
Rewatching
always
it.
Amazing.
Rewatching it tonight, I'm like, that guy is going to make a great Star Wars villain. He is really guy. If his character in this was a Star Wars villain, that would be a unique Star Wars villain.
So he's just so inherently interesting as an actor. Every choice he makes is interesting.
Really
it's funny
are.
Because there's something so similar about every single one of his performances where it's like I'm kind of looking at it like it's Adam Driver, but at the same time, I'm just endlessly fascinated by him.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you all for listening. If you want to keep up with this podcast, you should follow us on Twitter. Perry, where can we find you on Twitter?
You can catch me at P. Nemiroff.
Adam, what about you?
At Adam Chitwood.
And you can find me at Matt Goldberg. Thank you for listening, everyone, and we'll be back with you next week.